Well, hello everyone. You're sort of all spread out, but I'll try and look around the room a little bit so we see everybody. So, frames. They perform a function of focusing our attention on something, drawing our eyes to the right place. They spark a relationship between us and the space enclosed by the frame. Frames heighten. They can take something already extraordinary and push it even further, like this picture of the Himalayan mountains. Frames can take something familiar, perhaps something we encounter every day and don't really notice, and bring it to our attention. Frames create distance, they set apart, they are invitations to engage, to interact, and see things differently. Much of what we are going to talk about today is about framing the familiar. A pattern language was written principally by the architect and teacher Christopher Alexander, was first published in 1977. It and its companion volume, The Timeless Way of Building, form part of a larger series that sets up a philosophy about building and looking at the way that people interact with the spaces around them. These two volumes, quote, describe an entirely new attitude to architecture and planning. The books are intended to provide a complete working alternative to our present ideas about architecture, building, and planning. They've been very popular and very influential, mostly outside of the world of architecture, and maybe in ways not originally intended by the authors, but they probably don't mind that much. I will talk a little bit about that later. Alexander seeks to create towns that are alive. His main model for human-scale ways of building are medieval towns and villages, where people live in close proximity, where there is a lively public space, and where the town has come together in an organic fashion. His methods are a reaction against the highly planned, car-centric modern suburbs. He asks, what makes certain cities timeless and alive? His aim is to create living patterns that have a quality without a name. The more living patterns there are in a place, a room, a building, or a town, the more it comes to life as an entity, the more it glows. The more it glows, the more it has that self-maintaining fire, which is the quality without a name. What we want to talk about today is specifically this, the pattern language, and why it has opportunities for us. It's highly structured. The book sets out 253 patterns that come together to form an overall language. Alexander uses the language metaphor as a way to stress how each pattern is like a word that can be used over and over, and the result of the communication depends on the context of the word. The emphasis and the sequence. We can build utilitarian prose, or we can write poetry, depending on the sequence and implementation of the patterns. Language is performative. And Alexander asks us to think about architecture in the same way. Thus, each pattern is dependent on others for the creation of the whole. You see, I'm also just working in pictures I really like. So you might recognize where this is. The patterns are arranged in a hierarchy, moving from big elements, like independent regions, number 128, indoor sunlight, and finally the pattern 253, things from your life. These 253 patterns, according to Alexander, are part of the most important elements in building in a timeless way. The patterns, like language, form a network, each referring to others related to it, and like the words in language, dependent on context to give it meaning. Words can build up, or they can destroy, and it's up to the speaker to determine how they use the language. And he writes, this is a fundamental view of the world. It says that when you build a thing, you cannot merely build a thing in isolation, but must also repair the world around it and within it, so that the larger world at that one place becomes more coherent and a more whole, and the thing which you make takes its place in the web of nature as you make it. So back to the overall structure. So each pattern within a language follows the same form. Alexander writes, each pattern describes a problem which occurs over and over again in our environment, and then describes the core of the solution to that problem in such a way that you can use this solution a million times over without ever doing it the same way twice. So this is really the core of how this pattern language works. So the key to using the patterns is not to follow a set or tightly written instructions. They do not tell you how to specifically implement each design. They don't tell you what lamp to buy or what rug goes with what sofa. Rather, the patterns get at those things which make each element work well, and it's up to the builders and the designers to determine the best way to bring the pattern to life according to the context of each situation. Each pattern is intended to get at the heart of the matter. For example, we can look at pattern number 180, a window place. So everybody loves window seats, bay windows with low sills and comfortable chairs drawn up to them. So in the following pictures, we can see a number of examples of window places. Each of these examples contains the basic elements that, according to Alexander, make them work. In each example, the window has become a place, but each is quite different. The window place, the pattern instructs, make it low and self-contained, keep the sill low, set the window deep in the wall, and soften the light at the edges. I don't know if anybody recognizes where this is. I think I've actually sat there. So each of these has created a place around the window, but the context of the environment means that they are different. And as I mentioned above, these patterns are not used in isolation. Each has connections to those above it in the hierarchy and some below. Not all elements are required, but these links provide possibilities for creating an overall harmony. And here we can see the links to the other patterns in the window example. So we go back to sort of the fundamental way the pattern language is set up. We can see that it's problem, context, solution, discussion, and solution. Each has a title. And each is connected to each other through a network, although there are different weights placed on those other elements. So this is from Wikipedia, because I actually thought it was worded pretty well, so I've got it up here, no matter what you think of Wikipedia. But, so a pattern language is a structured method of describing good design practices within a field of expertise. It is characterized by noticing and naming the common problems in a field of interest, describing the key characteristics of effective solutions for meeting some stated goal, helping the designer move from problem to problem in a logical way, and allowing for many different paths through the design process. So, in a fairly easy leap from this idea, we get a pattern language for gardens. There's only a few patterns because it's a fairly small application. This next one, you can sort of see that graph underneath of what this implementation of the pattern language looks like. And this is a conservancy group, and they've used a pattern language to build a model for of environmental sustainability. Liberating Voices. This is another implementation of the framework of a pattern language. And it's built with the aim of instituting a communication revolution. And this one is actually a community-built framework, so you have actually people contributing patterns through a wiki. But perhaps one of the areas most influenced by a pattern language is computer programming. The model is used extensively to solve programming problems, and numerous books and websites have been developed to show how patterns can be used. This is a screenshot of the Yahoo Developer Network, and it contains hundreds of patterns. So how can patterns help us? What do patterns have to do with libraries? This might have seemed like a very long time without mentioning the word library. You might have been wondering, when are we going to get around to talking about libraries? But like the door at the very first slide, this introduction has built a frame through which we can view the rest of the presentation. Libraries come in all sorts of shapes and sizes and have an endless number of problems of all different sizes. In many different areas, some with what seem to be obvious solutions and others not so much. We want to discover what works well, why do they work well, what are those underlying things that make them work, what are the things that don't work, and what are the things that were maybe meant to solve one problem and do something else. We want people to engage with our spaces, with each other, with our materials, in our physical buildings, online, and even out in spaces we might not normally consider to be our spaces. As Alexander tells us, patterns help us find a problem that we see over and over again and then look for solutions that work in multiple scenarios. We think this is a valuable way to approach problems in libraries. So I had to include this picture too. You might recognize it because I always thought this was a bit problematic. If you don't recognize it, this is the entrance to Robarts Library at UT. It looks very welcoming, I think. And they actually close part of the stairways in the wintertime, making it extra, enjoyable. So we would like to propose that the pattern language model is a useful way to find and deploy the elements that build libraries in a timeless way. We could develop our own language of patterns, patterns that identify problems and find solutions to the elements we encounter in libraries over and over again, not with the aim of creating a homogeneous library with exactly the same text in every story, but we can build up a multitude of stories to tell the stories that are already there and so we can learn from each other. And to stoke that self-maintaining fire, which is the quality without a name, that makes libraries special in important places in society. Now, I just put a few pictures here if we can sort of see what the common, it's a very common, obvious common element, but I was sort of saying, like, shelves are always a problem. Maybe there's a pattern language for shelves. And this is also one, a picture I quite like. So how can we work together towards building the one big library? I'm going to turn it over to Bill.
The One Big Library isn't our idea. I was introduced to it by Wendy Newman, former chief librarian at Brantford and now senior fellow of the Faculty of Information at U of T. She's around and she's giving a talk tomorrow morning. One day at library school, I dropped by her office to talk about something that I've long since forgotten because all I remember now is this. She said, "It seems like there are lots of different kinds of libraries. Public libraries, school libraries, university libraries, college libraries, law libraries, medical libraries, corporate libraries, special libraries, private libraries. But really, there's just one big library with branches all over the world. The one big library is big. The one big library is every library in the world, and the one big library is everybody who works in them. The one big library is all of the collections, the books, the magazines, the music, the films, the archives, the special collections, the games and the toys lent out to children. It's all of the databases we buy access to and the downloadable audiobooks and the streaming music from Naxos. The one big library is all of the services, the collection building, the reference work, the cataloging, the classification, the instruction and the teaching. The one big library is interlibrary loan. The one big library is all of the infrastructure. It's all of the buildings, it's all of the universities and colleges where library people are trained, and it's the union catalogs. The one big library is all of the standards. It's the catalog cards invented in the 1890s. It's the Anglo-American cataloging rules, and it might be resource description and access. The one big library is MARC, but not forever. The one big library is all of the online catalogs and all of the discovery layers we're making now. The one big library is all of the consortia, where we work up at York. Our library is part of OCL, the Ontario Council of University Libraries, and CARL, the Canadian Association of Research Libraries, and the Association of Research Libraries, the ARL. All of us doing the same kind of work and dealing with the same sorts of problems. The One Big Library is all of the collaborations. Within OCL, we have Scholars Portal, an enormous collection of journal articles and e-books and other online resources. And recently we settled the Thunder Bay Agreement, where all the Ontario universities have agreed to will keep the last print copies of journals so that the others can free up shelf space. The One Big Library is all of the associations, the city chapters, the provincial, the state, the regional associations, the Canadian Library Association, the American Library Association. By being a member of the OLA, you're also a member of IFLA, the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions, you and people from all over the world from every continent. The One Big Library is all of the conferences. The OLA brings together all of the different kinds of librarians in Ontario. We talk to each other and learn what each other is doing and about how what someone else is doing could be used at our own library or how we could lend them a hand. The One Big Library is strong in Ontario. Knowledge Ontario, Ask Ontario, Our Ontario, Scholars Portal, the Tri-University Group, SOLS, the Ontario Library Service North, the Federation of Ontario Public Libraries, the OLBA, the OPLA, OLITA, and OCULA. And the One Big Library is all of the virtual libraries, not only Our Ontario, but Manitoba and Canadiana.org and Europeana. The One Big Library is what Brewster Kahle wants to achieve with the Internet Archive, universal access to all knowledge. The One Big Library is built on openness, and the One Big Library is open access, open standards, open data, open notebooks, open source, open stacks, open doors, open minds, and open hearts. The One Big Library is all of our values. As Michael Gorman listed them, stewardship, service, intellectual freedom, rationalism, literacy and learning, equity of access to recorded knowledge and information, privacy, and democracy. And the One Big Library is all of the people in all of the libraries. It's us and it's you. It exists and it's all around us, but it's not complete. There are many missing rooms in the one big library, many missing collections, many locked doors, many dilapidated corridors, many portables in the parking lot. I used interlibrary loan as an example. It's been a key library service for possibly centuries, but it's not as good as it could be. Back in 1999, Steve Kaufman wrote an article called Building Earth's Largest Library. And his idea was that libraries should do the same thing that Amazon was doing, but with interlibrary loan instead of sales of books. We'd pool all of our catalogs and our holdings information into one big catalog and provide local views on it. If a Toronto Public Library user had looked for a book that TPL had in, it would say it was immediately available. If TPL didn't have it, but Ryerson or the Mississauga system did, then it could say it could get it for them in 2 or 3 days, take care of the transfer behind the scenes. If it had to be found in Vancouver or Georgia, it would say it would take about a week. One big catalog with all the holdings information showing all of the users where everything is. And that article is about 10 years old now, and it feels both very much of its time and like something that we still can't build. U of T, Ryerson, York, and OCAD are all connected through OCL and a special interlibrary loan system, and everyone can borrow from anyone else, but the catalogs are unconnected. There's no easy way for York to tell people at Ryerson that we have a book that they don't. The Toronto Public Library system is totally unconnected from all of us, as are Mississauga, Hamilton, Vaughan, and everything else nearby. We're a bunch of small local libraries that work together, not one big library. The Open Library is doing something in this vein that is an example of the one big library. They made an announcement a few days ago about a project they're doing with the Boston Public Library. They say, "We are excited to announce a new program to allow users and patrons to scan on demand. It's simple to use. Just search for a public domain book on openlibrary.org. And if it's at the Boston Public Library and hasn't been scanned yet, there will be a Scan This Book button on the left-hand side. When you click on the button and follow the steps to confirm, we'll have the librarian go up, get the book from the stacks, bring it to our scanning center, and have our team of scanners digitize it page by page. Within 3 to 5 days, you should receive an email follow-up with a link to the newly digitized copy, complete with PDF, online flipbook, full text, OCR'd, and more, all thanks to your request. This is the One Big Library." The One Big Library's reference and how anyone can ask a question, and we have a worldwide system of information and people who will help us find the answer. Karen Schneider was at a conference last week and said on Twitter, "Guy asks why librarians don't build central site for online reference. Because we're feudal and don't work across organizational and geographic lines?" But here in Ontario, there's something that's a very good example of One Big Library growing and traditional divisions breaking down. Ask Ontario, the virtual reference service run by Knowledge Ontario. The Ottawa Public Library just joined up. Now there are 23 public libraries, 9 colleges, and 5 universities working for Ask Ontario, giving distributed but nearby reference. And the One Big Library is physical libraries, and it's digital libraries, and it's also virtual libraries. You may have read the recent Guardian article called Why You Can't Find a Library Book in Your Search Engine. There was an interesting quote at the end from Karen Coyle, an expert on digital libraries and metadata. She said, "If library records were open access on the web, it would be possible to create bibliographies that go beyond the buildings of any one library." She points to Kosovo, where libraries have been destroyed in generations of conflict. Open records, she says, could create a virtual library of books published in that geographical region, which would allow scholars to study the literature and history of that area in a way that is impossible today with our separate physical libraries. A virtual library, or many virtual libraries, echoing the holdings of destroyed libraries. No branch is ever bombed or burned in the One Big Library. The same article says that the National Library of Sweden has put its entire catalog on the web as linked data, the first effort by a national library to become part of the semantic web. The One Big Library isn't the semantic web, but they work very closely together. Semantic web people are very interested in libraries, and more librarians are interested in the semantic web. One of them is Dan Chudnov, who works at the Library of Congress. He and another fellow started the loose and informal Code for Lib group of library geeks, which has gone from an IRC channel to a journal and a popular annual conference. His website is onebiglibrary.net, and I asked him what his idea of the One Big Library is. He said, "Something between what Borges described and Steve Kaufman's Earth's Largest Library, with a flavor of complete data interlinkedness expressed in both a variety of SF titles over the years, and more recently with linked data and the web of data, which both come from Sir Tim Berners-Lee, most likely, with a solid core of a bibliographic backplane, which, as far as I know, is my own coinage. But not everybody is impressed with the idea of the one big library. A colleague of mine, Sophie Bury, said, "Is there one big hospital? One big school? Is everything one big?" Doctors and nurses and medical technicians all hold the same values. There are public hospitals, private hospitals, free clinics, research centers, all trying to make sick people better. The research is shared in journals. Doctors here can perform surgery on patients on other continents using remote control. And Doctors Without Borders sets up hospitals where they're needed and when. There are nursery schools, elementary schools, high schools, SAGEPs, colleges, universities, all with teachers who, I hope, are trained in the best and most appropriate methods of instruction. There are common principles and values and pedagogical methods, though they're expressed very differently and in different forms in different schools. So maybe there is one big hospital and one big school. They each have some common fundamental nature, something that connects them and makes them all the same, even when they are very different. They're part of something worldwide, but each local instance needs to be perfectly suited to its community, the same as libraries. Maybe there are more one bigs than we thought. But Walt Crawford doesn't like the idea at all. Sorry, but I don't buy it as a reality or as a desirable future. I don't think of Harvard College Library as a branch of the ARL, much less Mountain View Public Library, Harvard College Library, the New York Public Library, Hewlett-Packard Corporate Libraries, and the Poissippi Public Library as all being branches of one big library. I think of all of these as distinctive and distinctly local institutions, institutions which, being libraries, are really good at sharing and should get even better at it. But sharing is quite different than being a branch of the whole. Poissippi. Poissippi, Wisconsin, population in the 2000 U.S. Census, 972. Poissippi Public Library used to be located on the second floor of the old Poissippi School. When the old school was replaced, the library moved to its present location in the former first and second grade classrooms. And the Poissippi Public Library has a website. Poissippi recently added 6 new databases to its collection, including 2 on car repair. Poissippi brought back its new books blog due to popular demand. And Poissippi has a subject guide available in Spanish. Just from a few things on their web, they seem to be pretty responsive to what the users want. The librarian must know everybody in town and knows what people are reading and knows what the town needs. So Poissippi is distinctive and distinctly local, like Walt says. And the Poissippi is part of the Winnifox Library System, which covers 5 counties and is a shared catalog. It's one of 17 systems in the state, and it's the busiest per capita. They're part of a shared online reference service, and anyone in the town can get reference help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you or I walked into the Poissippi Public Library and wanted a book or needed to check our email, then they'd help us, same as anywhere else. The librarian there does the same work as we do, holds the same values, has the same problems. She builds her collection, she answers reference questions. Poissippi is part of the One Big Library. Walt did say many distinctive libraries. The One Big Library is made up of just that. And this is a quote from A Pattern Language from Christopher Alexander from the chapter on towns and communities. "We do not believe that these large patterns, which give so much structure to a town or neighborhood, can be created by centralized authority or by laws or by master plans. We believe instead that they can emerge gradually and organically, almost of their own accord, if every act of building, large or small, takes on the responsibility for gradually shaping its small corner of the world to make those larger patterns appear there." By building a library pattern language, we can do this with libraries. The One Big Library isn't generic and mass-produced. It's not Walmart or IKEA. Each branch of it must be special and different, just right for the people that use it, using just the patterns that make it the best library for its unique situation. And that branch could be anywhere. The One Big Library holds all the biggest libraries, but also all the smallest, even your personal library, your personal branch of the One Big Library. Here's part of this girl's personal library. I think she'd have a nice collection of books too, but this is her study, Carol. She has her computer. She's using iTunes, listening to music. She has a dictionary there on the left. She has textbooks. She has some games, and she has a cat, because every library needs a cat, especially a cat that sits on your book when you're doing your homework. And this is the start of her personal branch. She's going to build it all her life, through school and everything after. It'll have books and magazines and music and movies, all the usual stuff you'd have in a library, all built on library principles, even though it's just for her. Her personal library will also include her archives, all her digital photographs, the videos, the letters, the report cards, and her email, her web pages, her bookmarks, her Wikipedia edits, and her source code, all part of her personal branch. The library pattern language will apply to personal branches. Some patterns will work there at the small scale, and others will help the personal branches connect with others and to the rest of the world. Some will be about physical collections, and some will be about the online. Now, you're probably an expert on something. There's something you know really well, more than most people. You may have some books about it, photocopies, pictures, films, maybe you have a blog or a website. It's a special collection. And you're building and managing a special collection. What if you want to share it? What if you want to make your special collection available to other people? That's one of the library values that we all share. You could open up your living room and let people drop in. There used to be an anarchist library in Toronto that was run by a guy out of his apartment. And I went there once. It was a bit smelly, but he was friendly, and it really was a library. You could make your special collection available on the web. People do that every day. Every day, people expose part of their personal branch of the One Big Library. And if they do it with good tools, standards-based tools, even if they don't know what those standards are, like coins or Atom, then every other branch can tap into theirs automatically. It's not hard to put your personal library catalog online either, especially with Library Thing. Even if you don't even have to be alive to use Library Thing. There are a group of people who are entering the personal libraries of dead people. Dead people like Sir Richard Francis Burton, the Victorian explorer and adventurer and translator. People are entering in the books he owns so that you can browse through a virtual version of Burton's library. Even lost branches can be brought back in the One Big Library. A good library provides good tools for people to do their work, and anyone doing research will need special tools to manage their special branch. Zotero is a good example of this. It's a Firefox extension that helps you collect, manage, and cite your research sources. No matter what you're researching, big or small, whatever you're doing on the web, you can save it in Zotero, organize it, even save snapshots of web pages, and then annotate them. Late in 2007, and there have been no updates about this since, so I don't know what's going on with it, Zotero announced that they and the Internet Archive were starting the Zotero Commons. The plan is that scholars who have scanned in or copied old books and documents for the research and are managing them with Zotero can upload them to the archive, which will make them available to everyone. They could even upload them with all of their annotations. Then you or I could download that to our Zotero collection, a special collection built and maintained by an expert who's gone from one personal branch up to a very public branch of the One Big Library, then back down to our personal branches. People have had personal libraries for millennia, but the idea of personal branches means that we have a new job ahead. We work in branches of the One Big Library, but if everyone's personal library is a branch of that One Big Library, where do we fit in? What do we do? What does it mean if everyone is a librarian of the One Big Library? If more and more will be digital and online and done elsewhere, how does this change how we work? And we think the answer comes through openness, by opening up libraries and our conceptions of what is up to us. We can't always just stay in our branches. We need to work on the whole One Big Library. And we think that we'll come through taking on a new job that will make the One Big Library even bigger. This is the new job. Help people build, manage, and share their personal branches of the One Big Library.
I'm sort of going to back it up a little bit. Last June, we started taking initial steps to thinking about the One Big Library, and I think there were a couple people here who were at our One Big Library Unconference that took place in June 2008. So around this time last year, a small group of us at York, in our Emerging Technologies Interest Group, were in a meeting discussing various issues. We were sure other libraries in Oakville were likely dealing with many of the same problems that we were talking about. And wouldn't it be a great thing if we'd be able to get together and discuss these problems, maybe even explore ways to find common solutions? So the One Big Library Unconference was born out of this conversation that we were having about discussing our common problems, looking for common solutions. So it was organized by Bill, our colleague John Dupuy, and myself, and graciously sponsored by York's Chief Librarian, Cynthia Archer. And if you received your latest copy of Access OLA, you will actually see an article about the unconference in that issue. So now we've heard about the sort of theory of the One Big Library. And this is the theme we actually chose for our unconference. But what is an unconference? Well, an ONCOM conference is not like a regular conference, like the one we're at right now. It's entirely participatory. It lacks the usual heavy structure that comes with a formal conference. There was no formal call for presentations, no fancy printed program, no bag of swag, no registration fees, and up until 10 a.m. of the day of the conference, no program. The program was decided and run by the conference participants. This model was it comes out of IT, and you can see that it actually reflects many of the same principles coming out of Web 2.0. It's about empowering individuals, participation, and sort of getting out, being creative. The organizers are really there to only facilitate, to make sure there's enough coffee, to make sure there's projectors, if they're there, to make things start and end on time. And really, we didn't actually have to do too much work as far as hours put in, but we did have to sort of, I guess, hope that people were going to come, which they did, and that they were willing to pitch in, which they were, including moving furniture around. So the way we actually set up the ONCOM conference was through a wiki. It's still up if you want to go have a look. And we started off with an introductory page, giving details about the theme, where it is, what it is, how you sign up. And aside from the location, we decided actually that we didn't want to have it in York. York's a bit far away from downtown Toronto, if you've ever been there. It kind of takes a while to get there. So we thought maybe people wouldn't want to come all the way up to York. So we ended up holding it at the Centre for Social Innovation, which actually worked really well for the conference because it actually fit in with a lot of the ideals of the One Big Library, all about sort of grassroots initiatives. They have a green roof, which I think many of us enjoyed looking at. They discourage use of disposable materials, which meant we got to use all their dishes. And they like to keep their air conditioning a bit low. It was rather warm. So we encourage people also to bring their own water bottles, their own coffee cups, and I think this whole environment helped us to think about different ways to share. The space reinforced the ideals of sharing. We were also amazed at how quickly our 80 spots filled up. We had to create a waiting list, and we had people sign up from Quebec, Ontario, Virginia, Ohio, all different kinds of libraries, and different ranges of experience. But as we heard Bill telling us, we were all members of the One Big Library, and everybody came ready to participate. So what was it all about, the ONCOM conference? Well, we said, in an interconnected world, all physical and virtual libraries can really be thought of as branches of the One Big Library. We would like to get together and explore the concept. Our areas of interest are the future of libraries, collaboration on building the One Big Library collections and services, uses of social software in libraries, tools to support and extend the One Big Library. And just in case you weren't there, this is actually how we designed the program. It's a bit dim, but we set out these sheets on tables, and everybody could add in a suggestion, and then you see at the bottom what those dots are actually votes. So we set those out on tables, so people could go around and make suggestions and vote, and it was actually a really social beginning to the day, which I think was very nice. And this is how we came up with our program. Here's our program. This is our official program. So you can see from the picture here that it was a bit, well, as I said, not quite like the OLA. We wrote it up on a big piece of poster paper so people could have a look at it through at the first coffee break. And we had sessions like open access, open book, cataloging metadata, tagging, evergreen, and maybe you can get a sense of what the day ended up being like. And here's a photo of the open access session. You can see from this picture, again, not quite like your typical conference, not like we're set up now. It was all about being in big circles, everyone talking. There were a few people who did volunteer. They were very brave to sort of act as the leaders, but very quickly it just turned into a discussion. And again, what we noticed about all the sessions is they were really focused on openness. And we were quite, I think, a bit surprised, but also encouraged by that. Really about open everything. And here's just a little taste. I'm not on Twitter. I know Bill's on Twitter, but I have a feeling that it might be too much commitment for me. I might just be too drawn in. But there was some Twitter chatter, various blog postings, and we were, again, quite excited and maybe hope to do it again. And the things we learned with the conference is that people have a strong desire to talk to one another, to share experiences and find common solutions to common problems. We share many of the same concerns, no matter what kind of library we're at, what kind of library we're engaged in, and there's a strong desire to work together. And I think actually, in looking at the pattern languages, is something I did after the unconference. I can see that actually the way the sessions worked is actually we were building patterns. We were coming up with problems, discussing issues, and discussing solutions. So, given all the things we've heard about up till now, the One Big Library idea, the pattern language approach, we're going to give it a try, actually. So here are three clusters of problems, contexts, and solutions. So here's one to start off. So you can maybe guess what this cluster is. This is my archetypal photo. And you can sort of see, well, I hope you can see. Looks a bit dim from here. But there's a girl working at a table in a cafe. She's using a pen. There's a laptop. And so we were thinking, well, what is it about coffee, and you want to have coffee, and you want to read? There's something about those elements that have to do with cafes that really do mean something to us. So the problem, the main elements of a cafe, and actually in the pattern language is a street cafe pattern, seem to share qualities with libraries, like reading, studying, and talking together in a relaxed setting. The growth and popularity of chains like Chapters has given rise to further pressure on libraries to create cafe spaces. However, many cafe implementations seem to fall a bit flat. So I'm just going to go through my little discussion here. So I like cafes. I like to read at cafes. And I like libraries. But are these things like peanut butter and chocolate? Should they go together? We have traditionally borrowed food from library spaces and even drinks for various reasons, and often very good reasons. Caretaking staff, rodents, and who really wants to smell pizza when you're trying to study for an exam? But a recent push towards a more user-centered focus, and it seems the feeling that we need to compete with big bookstores, libraries have been relaxing the food rule and even building cafes in their spaces. We do know cafes have a long and sometimes storied history as being places where writers and artists and intellectuals may gather, and they're important places in neighborhoods. People like to go to cafes to engage in discussions and just to read quietly. Alexander found this was true. In the street cafe pattern, he noted, when we worked at the University of Oregon, we compared the importance of such discussion in cafes and cafe-like places with the instruction students receive in the classroom. We interviewed 30 students to measure the extent that shops and cafes contributed to their intellectual and emotional growth at the university. We found that talking with a small group of students in a coffee shop and discussion over a glass of beer scores higher than examinations and laboratory study. But what makes a library cafe work or not? So I had to include this picture because I often do like to have a beer and read. So does that mean we should have bars in libraries? I don't know. I saw some people nodding. And this also brings up an important point. As you heard in the introduction, I'm doing some PhD work right now, and I often go to the reading room. York has a great graduate reading room. It's fairly new. And sometimes I like to go there and spend the whole day there. It's very long. But I notice that other people do that too. And you might study for a couple of hours, and then you really just need to take a break. And there's really not a great... There's somewhere you want to go, but there's not really a place around campus you want to go. And maybe it's a place like this. I mean, maybe there's something about that need to get away from the library. So what does that mean for our library spaces? Another little story. So Crit Stewart, Program Director for Research, Teaching, and Learning at the Association for Research Libraries and former director of Georgia Tech University, visited York several weeks ago, and he gave a talk about a big redesign that took place a couple of years ago at Georgia Tech. York is in the process of planning for a learning commons, and I was struck by his comments about the library cafe. He said that people don't use it as much as they thought they would, and there have been complaints about it being too clean, too neat, and generally not inspiring. And I found a photo of it on Flickr, and it was actually licensed under the Creative Commons license, so I could put it in the presentation. And I would agree, it's not very inviting. And even though it may not be the best photo, It really doesn't seem to be the kind of space that we want to spend much time in, yet it is a cafe and a library. So what is it about that implementation that maybe is not quite right? And how do we build spaces that we admire and spaces that make us happy? And actually, how is a library, I haven't quite figured this out, but how would a library cafe be different than a regular cafe? Are there things that should be in a library cafe that are different than a cafe you might find in your neighborhood? So I call this the library cafe pattern, and here are my solutions. So we should create rooms to foster an intimate feel. It shouldn't be too open, but some parts should be open to the public view, like a terrace. Offer a variety of seating, make it not all the same, not too matchy. Offer reading materials, games, things we don't mind getting messed up. Maybe we want to develop a special library cafe collection. Emphasize a local feel so that it's not too sterile. Offer a variety of food and drink, but maybe not full meals. Keep it sort of simple. Build it for different purposes and a variety of people who might use your space, and make it a restful place, especially in educational institutions. Okay, so here's my next pattern. And so you heard I'm a cataloger, so of course I had to include it in the catalog pattern. So here's my archetypal picture. And at first, this was a cluster that was accessed to metadata, and I really was having a hard time because I was getting all excited and you know, things was turning into a giant mess. And then I thought about the pattern language and realized that if Christopher Alexander can take something like a large region and write three pages on it, I hope I can write something short about metadata, maybe. So what is the problem? So we need lots of good metadata to run libraries, but the production of and access to metadata is being threatened. It is considered too expensive to produce locally by many libraries. The technology and standards used to create and exchange metadata are becoming antiquated. There is a greater desire for enhanced content, and there is a growing conflict between a movement to implement restrictive use policies and the rising strength of the open source movement. So, what's the context here? So the fight over bibliographic metadata has heated up in the past couple of months. Many maybe here have heard about the OCLC, how they want to introduce a new use policy. It's very restrictive. The policy as it is currently written would limit what libraries could do with their bibliographic records that reside or have ever resided in the OCLC database. And it also threatens libraries if they have an infraction that they'll actually call all their bibliographic records. And this move was rather shocking, not just because it sort of seems small-minded and backwards, but because it implies ownership over something many of us have considered to be free, shared, and available for use by all, or at least anybody with a Z3950 targetability. So protest rang out. There's a whole page on Code for Lib. You can actually read how it sort of unfolded. And as Bill mentioned, there was a recent article in The Guardian. And I'll just read a little quote from it. So you might expect forward-thinking libraries to put their databases online to encourage people through their doors, but they can't. Even though they created the data, pay to have the records added to the database, and pay to download them, they can't. In November, OCLC announced new rules covering the use of WorldCat data due to go live on the 19th of February. Among other things, the new policy prohibits any use, transfer, sharing that substantially replicates the function, purpose, and or size of WorldCat. In other words, no publicly searchable databases. So this is not very acceptable to many. So all of this protest meant that actually OCLC did respond, and they have struck a review board, but not many people feel that this means that they'll actually not go through with the policy. So what this example shows us is that the cornerstones for libraries, bibliographic data, is coming under increasing threat, exactly at a time when we need it most. This is not a coincidence. Good bibliographic metadata is a valuable commodity because it is needed and it can be bought and sold, much like what we see in academic publishing industry with scholars writing articles for free while publishers turn around and sell subscriptions at huge expense to libraries, often the articles being written by their faculty members. And OCLC is really no different. We pay to download records, we pay to upload records, we pay all the time for things that they actually don't produce. And this actually made sense OCLC at one point, when we needed some, when they had the technological ability to transfer, we needed the exchange mechanisms, but we don't need that anymore. So instead of seeking out new models of revenue, OCLC, like the record industry, is trying to hang on to outmoded revenue streams, trying to enforce what perhaps is not enforceable, or at least not a wise way to continue trying to generate revenue. Interesting. And OCLC's policy, when you think about it, is kind of like, you know, putting DRM restrictions on demographic records, and we see that in the record industry, they're getting rid of that. So it seems like maybe this is not a model they want to use. So a number of people have also suggested that this recent move comes as a result of the growing threat of projects like Library Thing, Open Library, and the LEO, projects that we think work towards building the one big library. So I'm just going to show a couple quick pictures. And I actually had the same quote, it was funny, from Karen Coyle in my slides here. So really, this really is an important issue. So again, we go to the Open Library, the idea of building one web page for every book, and it's a lofty but achievable goal, and it really is. If we look at their from their about page, it lists a few things, and none of these things are overly onerous, really. They are within our ability to do. And I also have to include this as another way we can think about cataloging into one big library, a catalog flash mob. Sounds exciting. And so a group of people went to a church library and using a Library Thing managed to put that collection up on the web, which is just a great thing. And again, with a little tip of the hat to the open access movement, how to free culture. So this is actually from the free from a university, from their free culture movement. So all that context to say, this is my library metadata commons pattern and the solution. So make bibliographic metadata open access. No question, open access. Adopt a model of free exchange of all bibliographic metadata. Make your bibliographic data available to others. Encourage the creation of metadata, preferably according to standards, preferably. Everyone has a role to play in creating the metadata commons. So even if you're a library that has reduced your technical services department to, well, let's say nothing or very small, that doesn't mean you still can't give back to the commons in other ways. Provide tangible incentives to metadata creators, especially institutions that actively support the creation of metadata. And develop open exchange methods. Promote the idea of the digital commons everywhere. So I'm actually going to hand it back over to Bill. Oh, I did actually have this last slide. I almost forgot about it. But again, just as a follow-up to the idea of the metadata commons, that really, again, like the idea of a commons, it's about a community effort and community support. So we can't necessarily think that metadata is just going to be created out there for fun, that there does have to be some sort of reason for it to sort of give back to the commons.
The third cluster, what I'm going to talk about, is about reference work. And this isn't a very good reference desk picture, but it's the best I could find with a CC license. I don't think you could do much beyond some quick reference here. There's no chair for that young woman to sit down in, and the desk is too high. And the monitor is the big wooden boxy thing in the middle, and it swivels, but it looks kind of awkward. But all of those sorts of problems about how the reference desk is built and how we sit with people can be worked on through the pattern language approach. And we think there are many reference desk patterns that can be applied in all different sorts of libraries, and each time applied differently to suit the particular library. I'm not going to talk about the physical layout and chair placement, though. I'm going to talk about how people with reference questions work with librarians to get answers. Now, I've only been working at reference desk for about a year and a half, so I have little experience with it, but there are a couple of things I've noticed, and I'll put them to you as patterns, and you can see what you think. Problem. When a person works with a librarian at the reference desk computer, all history and context is lost when the person leaves. A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting at the reference desk at the business library where I work, and a student came up and he said he came over from the law school. He was writing a paper about executive compensation, bonuses, and how it relates to risk-taking behavior. And he said he looked in all of his law databases, but hadn't been able to find anything. So the business databases had lots on the subject, and we spent about 25 minutes sitting there trying this search and that and finding and expanding and trying different terms and looking up names of people we knew had received huge bonuses. And we found a lot of material, and he was jotting down notes all the way. And then when we were done, he said, "Can you send me those searches?" And I couldn't. We'd done all this work together, building up a search history, but when he left the desk, it was completely lost. There was no way I could save that session and leave it somewhere, maybe even on ProQuest's website, so that he could pick it up and continue on. Looking at this from the one big library point of view, here was a whole set of work of search history and actions that came out of the his knowledge of the subject, my knowledge of the subject, and the reference interview that needed to be moved over into his personal branch. Call this pattern Save Collaboration. Solution: reference tools and services should allow the librarian and the user to collaborate on the work and let the session be passed over to the user without any loss of history or context so that the user can continue the work uninterrupted. Now you may think the example has been a very traditional sounding, a very academic library. Person comes up, talks to the librarian, use computer, person leaves, and that's, well, it's based on my experience, that is mostly how things work at York. But the way I phrased the pattern doesn't say where the reference session happens, at the desk or not, whether it happens with in person or online. If it's a virtual reference session, maybe with co-browsing, there could be other ways of the librarian and the user working together and then the user taking over the whole session. This could be something that Ask Ontario could think about, or maybe the people at McMaster with the work in Second Life. There's no mention of computers in the solution either. If the work was all done on paper, then the user should be equally able to take everything away and then continue on or recreate the work. And my context was academic, but I think the pattern is equally applicable to other libraries, though I wonder what children's librarians would think about it. How well it applies overall would need more examination, and the pattern could be refined. Here's another problem. It's impossible to learn a new system by watching someone else use it. One must use it oneself. Student comes up to the desk with a research problem, and then we're working away at the reference desk computer, which has two monitors, one facing me, one facing them. And we look here, and we look there, and I point out this, and see, I have to click that, and go up to text search, and then pull this down, and enter in this, but remember that this doesn't work, so you have to do that. And it's all bewildering. And if I show them two or three or five different sources to look in, then no matter how many notes they write down, how much they watch, no matter how much I explain, no matter who the reference desk arrangement is, then they're going to forget most of it. And the only way that they can really learn a system is to use it. So this pattern is the user's own computer. Where possible, work at the user's own computer. Use a library computer only where the user doesn't have one. Working together on their computer will take care of some of the problems behind the previous pattern. If the system you're using is unfamiliar, then the librarian can teach it, and the user will get to actually use it and learn by doing. And this pattern supports the idea of the personal branch of the one big library. If the person has the right tools on their computer, then they can use them right there and save what's found, and they'll be comfortable with those tools. But if there are any useful tools that they don't have, that they should have, then the librarian can help them get them installed right then so that the personal branch is fully functional. And this pattern also helps with accessibility issues. If the user has special screen magnifiers or voice readers, then they have to use it on their own computer. And how many other reference desk patterns we might find, we don't know. We need to look at all the different sorts of reference work that happens in all the different kinds of libraries and find the simple patterns behind the best, most productive, most beneficial, most rewarding reference encounters, the ones where the user and the librarian leave feeling happy and satisfied. The users and the levels of expertise, the subject areas, the available reference tools, all of that can change, but there are certain fundamentals about reference work and helping people find answers to the questions that are unchanging. And a pattern language approach will give solutions that can be used again and again to suit your particular situation. And we want to find other clusters of problems and find the solutions and patterns there. So we ask you to think about the problems and what solutions, what are the solutions that you use and what's essential about the solutions and what the solution has in common with other people so the patterns can be found. We talked about libraries as places and cataloging and reference work. Other possible clusters might include collection building. What are the patterns for building the best collection for our users? How do we customize our collection, the branch of the one big library? And how does it connect with the other branches? How do we use the expertise of our users? And how can they help build the collections they need? How local branches work together in a municipal public system? How should they organize and arrange themselves to best serve the town or city? And how should the branches in a school system or a university work together? Children's libraries and teen libraries. What makes a good one? What events should go on? What makes children happy in a library? Reader's advisory. What are the best ways of getting readers in touch with other readers so that they can, who can make them good recommendations? And libraries online. What patterns are both applicable to the physical and the virtual? What problems exist only online? Going at it in reverse, there are things that work very well and are the solution to some problem, but we don't quite know what it is and we don't know what the pattern is. When we don't know what the pattern is, we may apply the solution wrongly. Tagging is that on Delicious, people tag the web. On Flickr, people tag their photos. A library thing, people tag their books. They all work very well. In Amazon, you can tag books. In WorldCat, you can tag books. In some library catalogs, like at the University of Michigan, you can tag books, and they are all failures. Tagging is very successful in some places and useless in others. So why is that? What's going on there? What is the essence of the problem that tagging solves? And what is the underlying pattern? When that pattern is found, then we will know how, if we should use tags and where. So what happens next? What remains to be done? And what are we going to ask you to do? First thing we want you to do is to live and work in the one big library. Try out the idea, see if it makes sense to you, find your own understanding of it, look for holes in our argument. When you face a problem or are doing some work, say, how does this fit in the one big library? Remember all the other libraries or other branches just like you. Remember Ranganathan's fifth law, the library is a growing organism. Remember Brewster Kahle's universal access to all knowledge. Support openness in all its forms and be open. Build the library pattern language. Christopher Alexander described pattern languages in the search for the quality without a name, and we think that approach will help us understand the one big library. We need to find the problems, context, and solutions that will provide us with a pattern language for libraries. We think that many solutions and patterns are already out there, but not yet expressed this way. In other cases, it will be a lot of work to find them. When we know the patterns, apply them in your library, but apply them in the way that works best for you and your users. The patterns can be endlessly applied and reapplied, fresh and different each time. And then finally, making your branch of the one big library as good as it can be is still your job, but now we ask you to take on a new job as well, one that will get more important as the internet grows, help people build, manage, and share their personal branches of the one big library. On behalf of Stacy and myself, thank you very much.